we're going to be talking about some things that have to do with writings that have been on our site, but because of a recent study of 1 Kings 18 that I've been very immersed in for about 2 weeks now, one of the things highlighted to us is about the extended role of the bride. So we're going to be talking about that, pointing to some of our previous writings that deal with the bride. And also, we're going to go into four passages of scripture. And if you're wondering what's going to happen after the bride theft, well, that's going to answer some questions for you. So here on theopenscroll.com, we've got a column that's about the hope. And these are part of a collection we call When Cometh That Thief in the Night. And in this section called Piercing the Veil, we make reference to a lot of passages of scripture that have a lot to reveal about the bride theft and about the scenario of how redemption will roll out in the earth. So we've got this article on the bride theft also, and about the bridegroom and the bride, which is right here, and I've got those up on screen. If you think that the bride is Israel, you have been misled. There is more to it than that, and this will help you identify some very profound things about the bridegroom and the bride, and can't recommend it highly enough. It's very exciting. And the bride theft is a study that's been up on the Open Scroll for quite a while, but if it's language that's unfamiliar to you or you're not really sure what's involved with that, I invite you to take a look at that. These are really foundational to what we're going to talk about today, because we're going to talk about the extended role of the bride. Now, these scriptures that we're going to go to, you can see from my tabs, Genesis 45, and this is what Joseph and Benjamin, parts 1 and 2, focuses on. And these are prophetic scenarios that the Lord revealed to me many years ago as he was beginning to open up to me when what I know now as the bride theft is going to be happening. And it's an extended prophetic scenario where Joseph represents Jesus and Benjamin represents the bride. And the things done there are very eye-opening. In Acts 12, in this next tab, that's going to take us into passing through the iron gate. John 21 is going to take us into what's the subject here of the secret resurrections of John 21. What we're going to do as we go through these today is show you a specific focus on the role of the bride after the bride theft. And some of you may be thinking, ah, this is what's going to be taking place in heaven. And no, our focus is going to be on instead what's taking place on the earth. 1 Kings 18, this is the passage I mentioned that I've been working on. And this is going to be a very parallel passage focused on Elijah as a type of the bride. And that is the subject of this writing, Elijah's Got Answers by Fire. And because of my recent study, I've learned things that extend the scenario there. So I've taken the video that was produced offline, because it was a reading of this, and I've been updating this study, which has begun, but it's not done yet. So it's a very lengthy process because there's a lot of learning involved, and it's not ready to be released yet, and I can't say when it will be, but it is a work in progress. So without further ado, here we are in Genesis 45. Again, Joseph is a type of Jesus. Pharaoh's a type of God, his father. And Benjamin is a type of the bride. And the other brothers are a type of the 144,000. And if you don't know about the relationship between the bride and the 144,000, that's key. Absolutely key. And we've got several writings that deal with that. Many of these, or perhaps all of the piercing the veil writings, deal with the relationship between the bride and the 144,000. The sign for the bride certainly does. And primarily, I would say, this study that revolves around Romans chapter 11, what will their acceptance be but life from the dead? That's language that comes from the 15th verse of Romans chapter 11. Very key. If you're not familiar with that, that's an essential, absolutely critical. And I don't know, there's not too many places where you can get that. All right, so this is a extended type. It's a prophetic allegory. And so much of this is just kind of a straight translation of symbols as you track these individuals through time. And the key here is understanding about the time and what time you're looking at and what the dynamics are in the relationships between God's people. So that unfolds all of this. So after Joseph has his brothers come in to buy grain, he does some things that are really unusual. And eventually he reveals his identity to them as his brother, because they'd sold him out years before. And he was taken as a slave into Egypt. And then through a certain series of events, he became second only to Pharaoh. So we see here Joseph is sending them back to the land of Canaan to their father Jacob, Israel. And the plan is to bring them back to Egypt for preservation during the famine. And you might ask, well, couldn't God just feed them? Well, sure he could. Couldn't he just end the famine? Sure. Why was there a famine in the first place? Because, well, God does things for a reason. And one of the benefits that we have that happened is that it prophesies about what's yet to come in the future. There was a benefit then, and most certainly it's a benefit for us now as we're looking ahead to what's going to happen. And God does prepare his people in advance so that when things happen, they understand exactly what it means. So, Joseph gave them wagons in verse 21, according to the command of Pharaoh, and gave them provisions for the journey. To each and all of them he gave a change of clothes, but to Benjamin he gave 300 shekels of silver and 5 changes of clothes. Now, why is that significant? Because Benjamin is the bride. He is different from the other brothers. Benjamin alone, of all of his brothers, recognized who Joseph was, even though they'd never met, because Benjamin was just a baby when Joseph was sold into slavery. So, a change of clothes. Why a change of clothes? Well, because clothes represent the body, like a robe, a white robe. This is an indication that the Benjamin bride, who we understand had been taken in the bride theft already at this time, and at the meeting with Joseph in Egypt, was after the bride theft with the bride and the bridegroom together, and a meeting and a commissioning with the 144,000, kind of a special family reunion there. So the bride gets to participate in that. But not only that, here's Benjamin with a special appointment being sent off with the other brothers on their mission to go get Israel. So what does that mean? Is Benjamin no longer the bride? Oh no, he is the bride, and he's got a resurrection body, and he's going off on this mission. And why 300 shekels of silver? Well, there's a number of things that you could say about that. You could say time is money. He's got some kind of mastery of time thing going on. He's got some other special provision. And this is all necessary. Silver is a redemption symbol. Three is a resurrection number. And that's 300. That's a multiplied resurrection. So here's the bride being sent off, yes, in her glorified resurrection body. And you might say, well, where does that come from? How does that happen? Well, if you look in the Gospels, what happened after Jesus was raised from the dead? He made several appearances. And in Acts 1, it says that he, for 40 days, appeared in his resurrected body, and then he ascended. And so when Benjamin goes off, he is the bride who is doing as her bridegroom did. And we know that the bridegroom and many things that he did is symbolic of what the bride will do following in his footsteps, like in Gethsemane, when the Lord went off and prayed and all the others fell asleep. He was right there, a type of the bride who wouldn't sleep, who would be awake. So this is just one example, but look what happens here, and we're going to make a comparison a little bit later to 1 Kings 18. In verse 25 it says, so they went up out of Egypt and came to the land of Canaan to their father Jacob. And they told him, Joseph is still alive and he's ruler over all the land of Egypt. And really what this is they're proclaiming the gospel. Yeshua, yeah, remember him? Well, he's still alive, yep, raised from the dead. And guess what? He is in charge in heaven. He's seated at the right hand of the throne of God. So that's the message that's being proclaimed. So the gospel message about the resurrection, the death and resurrection, is not missing. You just have to recognize the symbolism and read it on the esoteric level. And his heart became numb, for he did not believe them. Okay, so the first response was a bit unbelievable to Jacob. But when they told him all the words of Joseph, which he had said to them, and when he saw the wagons that Joseph had sent to carry him, the spirit of their father Jacob revived. And you might think, well, yeah, those are special wagons from Egypt. Sure, but what is that? Egypt, with God, the Most High God, is the Pharaoh. These are the carts of heaven, the chariots of heaven, the chariots of fire, the chariots and the horsemen of Israel. And this is a witness to Jacob, the whole thing, the words of Joseph, the wagons. This is supernatural, and this is a show of what's coming and what's going to be part of the witness to Jacob. And we'll see this again in 1 Kings 18. Aaron, you have something you'd like to add?
Just wanted to mention, I don't think we have it loaded up there, but you did rather extensive writing on those carts of heaven that might be helpful to folks to get a hold of what you're really talking about there.
Yeah. Several of the writings here on the left-hand side are going to be useful with regard to understanding the background here. Step your way through. If any of them catch your eye, it's probably the Lord. Check them out. We talk about heaven's vehicles right there, which is the one that Aaron's talking about. We talk about the kingdom viaduct, which is also very relevant. There's also in this Bell's writing some relevant information there. So yeah, these wagons or carts are pretty significant. And if you want to see one description of them, you can see Ezekiel chapter 1 and chapter 10. So you'll have a sense of what exactly is going on here. They're multidimensional. So what happens to Jacob when he receives this witness? The spirit of their father Jacob revived, and Israel said, wait, why does it say Jacob and then Israel? Because, yeah, there's a transition, there's a change that happens. It's being marked right there. And he says, it's enough. Yeah, I'm convinced. That's it. That did it for me. Joseph, my son, is still alive. Yep. The descendant of Jacob, who is Yeshua, still alive. I will go and see him before I die while he's still alive. Yep. And so this is, in the language of Romans chapter 11, the second situation of grafting in of a natural olive branch into the root. The first was happening when they showed up and Joseph revealed his identity to the brothers. That was the first grafting in of the natural olive branch. That's 144,000. And then the 144,000 are sent on a mission to Jacob, Israel. And there's the second grafting in. And note that Benjamin goes along with him. He's not excluded from that. He's not explicitly mentioned there. But let's go to Acts 12 and see what we see. In the season when the Lord was revealing to me the extended prophetic scenario in Genesis, pivoting on Genesis 45, he led me rather directly into Acts chapter 12 as another extended prophetic scenario that showed the bride theft. And there's an interaction that takes place. And we have to understand that these things are parallel. The language is different, the times are different, so much is different. But when you understand about the events and the timing of the events, the parallels are not for no reason. They're like seeing the same scene from different angles. So I'm going to read here. Actually, Aaron, would you read for us from Acts 12, verses 6 through 12?
Now when Herod was about to bring him out on that very night, Peter was sleeping between two soldiers, bound with two chains, and sentries before the door were guarding the prison. And behold, an angel of the Lord stood next to him, and a light shone in the cell. He struck Peter on the side and woke him, saying, "Get up quickly." And the chains fell off his hands. And the angel said to him, "Dress yourself and put on your sandals." And he did so. And he said to him, "Wrap your cloak around you and follow me." And he went out and followed him. He did not know that what was being done by the angel was real, but thought he was seeing a vision. When they had passed the first and the second guard, they came to the iron gate leading into the city. It opened for them of its own accord, and they went out and went along one street, and immediately the angel left him. When Peter came to himself, he said, "Now I am sure that the Lord has sent his angel and rescued me from the hand of Herod and from all that the Jewish people were expecting." When he realized this, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose other name was Mark, where many were gathered together and were praying.
Now in this scenario, Peter gets out of prison, and this is the bride theft, where in verse 10 it says, when they passed the first and second guard, they came to the iron gate leading to the city. It opened for them of its own accord. And this is like the old Jerusalem, but think New Jerusalem. Peter leaves the prison that is this physical realm, and when he's putting on his clothes, according to what the angel is telling him here, he's putting on immortality, according to the language of 1 Corinthians 15. He's being clothed with his heavenly garments. And in this scenario, we've talked about this before, there's a keystone pattern here where passing the first and second guard. Then they come to the iron gate leading to the city. They go through that. So there's three things. And then in the fourth, you know, he's free. He goes along one street. And so the keystone pattern is here. It's also in Genesis 45, as we pointed out in the past, with the journeys of the brothers going in, and the journey going back to get Jacob is a fourth and a fifth, actually. They returned once. So when we see this, we understand how the Lord weaves the timing in, not just the keystone pattern, but also other aspects of timing in with these prophetic scenarios. Now, on this one, after the bride theft, what happens with Peter? Well, he goes to the house of Mary, and he bears testimony. So Peter in his resurrection body, and we point that out in the writing, passing through the iron gate. This is post-bride theft resurrection appearance. He's bearing testimony to these people. And it says in verse 17, then he departed and went to another place. So he's told them, go tell these things to James and to the brothers. And this is, James is the Greek form of the Hebrew Jacob. They're one and the same. So it's in essence saying, go report this to Jacob and the brothers. And so there's a parallel with Genesis 45. And then he departed and went to another place. Where is he going? What's he doing? Well, it doesn't tell us directly, and it really doesn't need to. It's enough to know that. But Peter, as a type of the bride here, is on a mission, on another mission. He's not just wandering around, got nothing better to do. He's not going to the pub. He's got a mission. And it's all about salvation. And there's a sequence of events. So now when we get to John 21, there's another keystone pattern that we've talked about that's evident here. I would say more than one. And in this scenario, it's got kind of an obvious resurrection deal, because this is one of the resurrection appearances of Jesus to his disciples. And it's famous for a catch of 153 large fish in a net, which is a resurrection scenario. But there are secret resurrections going on here. And there's a very significant weaving in of information about timing here. But for our purposes, our primary interest here is on the continued mission of the bride after the bride theft. I'm going to show you in verse 7, Aaron, if you would read verses 7 and 8, we'll talk about that.
That disciple whom Jesus loved, therefore, said to Peter, "It is the Lord." When Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he was stripped for work, and threw himself into the sea. The other disciples came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from the land, but about 100 yards off.
Right. Now, Aaron, we know that when we were in Acts 12, the angel showed up and told Peter, yeah, get dressed, because we're out of here. And they had a little prison break. And now, what's he doing here? Before he's jumping in the water, he's what?
He is putting on his outer garment, sir, before he jumps in the water.
And what is prompting this exactly?
That the disciple whom Jesus loved saying, "It is the Lord," which is a great representation of the 144,000 sons of Israel recognizing Yeshua as their true Savior.
That's right, because of the cryptic declaration in Revelation, in Romans chapter 11, verse 15, what will their acceptance be but life from the dead? And so we understand these things because of the principles that are set forth in a way that seems direct, but most people miss. And then we see over and over again in these prophetic scenarios, kind of masked as a dramatic story, but we understand these are yet future, as the Lord is bringing these things to pass, or about to bring them to pass. He's preparing the way. And so the key on all these is the understanding of the timing. That's how I came to them, and there is no other way. The understanding of the timing is critical to unfolding these things, even the continued role of the bride. So here we see the bride theft, and then we see the other disciples come in, and they're going to join in, and the 144,000 very specifically is pictured in the disciple whom Jesus loved. So this is a key interaction. It's a grafting in of the natural olive branch, and that triggers the resurrection. So Peter is again the bride, like in Acts 12, and we got the numbers 12 and 21 back to back here. You know what that means? Time reflected on itself. So they have a little incident here where they're meeting on the shore with Jesus. They bring in the catch of fish. And this is now the third time that Jesus was revealed to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. And if there was ever a statement about the three being the resurrection number, that would certainly do it. It just soaks this scenario in resurrection. There's obvious and hidden. So after that, after they finish breakfast, Jesus is talking to Simon Peter. Now remember, Peter's the bride. He's there, been a part of the bride theft. We're not cycling back again. Consider that this is in sequence, that this is part of the event after they finish breakfast. There's a connection. And then he goes through this feed my lambs, feed my sheep situation, and there's a keystone pattern there. And in this, it's talking when Jesus makes this proclamation in verse 18, it's talking about his life and beyond. Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted. But when you were old, you will stretch out your hands and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go. What's going on there? Verse 19, this he said to show by what kind of death he was to glorify God. And after saying this, he said to him, follow me. Oh, maybe after his death. Yeah, there's a lot of ways to look at this. And this will become a lot more plain in days to come. But this is about the end of his physical life as Peter. This is about the end of the bride and also what's beyond. Now, if we take the linear sequence into account, Peter still has the bride after the bride theft. He sees the disciple whom Jesus loved following them, the 144,000. This is the same one who leaned back against him during the supper and it said, Lord, who is it that is going to betray you? And we understand this is with respect to Judas and the revelation of Judas, which is a show of the baptism of the lawless one. And that is the key dynamic when the bride has the pivotal interaction with the 144,000. So this identification is very vivid, and we understand what's going on there. But look at what's happening. When Peter saw him, he said to Jesus, Lord, what about this man? Jesus said to him, if it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me. So here we are in the last days, and when the 144,000 are a group and they've been sealed and they're on their mission, there they are following Jesus. Look in Revelation chapter 14 and you'll see, standing on Mount Zion, the Lord who is the Lamb. And we've just been talking about the lambs and the sheep. And he's with 144,000. And it says that they follow him everywhere he goes. And so here they are, they're following him, the Lamb. And so they've been sealed, they're on their mission. Where are they going? Well, their mission is to Israel. Because the next olive branch, that's the natural olive branch, has got to be grafted into the tree. That's their mission. Just like in Genesis 45, when Benjamin and the brothers were sent off to fetch Jacob. So here they go. They're on their mission. And Peter goes with them. Right? He goes with them. And this is, you know, if it wasn't over and over again, we'd think, well, that's a possibility, but not really convincing. But when you see these over and over again, it gets rather convincing. So let's go here. And now in 1 Kings 18, we have a scenario that's got keystone pattern and reset of time, doubling of Shemitah, all these elements that are woven in. And again, it's a story of the interaction between the bride and the 144,000 and the mission, where both the bride and the 144,000 are involved, and they're going off to Israel so that Jacob's spirit can be revived. And this is a beautifully rich sequence. And 1 Kings 18 is followed by 1 Kings 19, and it's really all part of the same context. And I wanted to show you here what I've got in progress in the Chiasmatron 2000. But this is 1 Kings 18, and I tie it in to 1 Kings 19, and I'm not exactly sure how I'm going to break this up for presentation, because there's more on the front end of this, and I may just clip part of it out because it's so big it's kind of unwieldy and more easy to present in pieces. But yeah, this is part of what I've been working on for the last couple of weeks. The main part didn't really take me that long, but in the learning and exploration of the different things and figuring out how to present it, you see I've got quite a lot of commentary here. It's been a big project. I had no idea how extensive, how demanding the work was going to be, or anything else that Aaron and I have had going on over here in the last couple of weeks, but yeah. So let's go into 1 Kings 18 here. And just to set this up, if you haven't read it, you'll probably want to read the whole chapter. But basically, Elijah comes to the people and says, how long will you go limping between two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him. Well, that seems like kind of an obvious thing, right? They're Israel. Shouldn't they know their God is God? But look, and the people did not answer him a word. Whoa, what? Yeah, there's a problem here. There's a serious problem here. This is the state, the condition of Israel. It's not good. There hadn't been rain for 3 years. The famine was heavy. Once again, God is controlling things and setting things up, not just to bring his people around in that time, but as a prophecy to show us what's yet to come. So we know in advance, not only what, but when, because when, again, is the key. So they have this contest, and the God who answers by fire is God. That's going to be the sign. And so they've got to sacrifice all the prophets of Baal, set up theirs, and Elijah's going to set up his. And Aaron, if you would, I'd like you to read verses 30 through 40, everything I've got in blue there.
Then Elijah said to all the people, "Come near to me." And all the people came near to him. And he repaired the altar of the Lord that had been thrown down. Elijah took 12 stones, according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord came, saying, "Israel shall be your name." And with the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord. And he made a trench about the altar, as great as would contain 2 seahs of seed. And he put the wood in order, and cut the bull in pieces, and laid it on the wood. And he said, "Fill 4 jars with water, and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood." And he said, "Do it a second time." And they did it a second time. And he said, "Do it a third time." And they did it a third time. And the water ran around the altar and filled the trench also with water. And at the time of the offerings of the oblation, Elijah the prophet came near and said, "O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known this day that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and that I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you have turned their hearts back." Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and said, "The Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God." And Elijah said to them, "Seize the prophets of Baal. Let not one of them escape." And they seized them. And Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and slaughtered them there.
Now that's a pretty decisive victory in anybody's book. And the prophets of Baal had been humiliated, being unable to produce any fire. And when you consider this, it was really very significant historically. But because it's picturing in the grafting in of the natural olive branch Israel, it's very significant. But the sequence that leads to it is very symbolic and important. And it shows Elijah as the bride and the altar as the 144,000. And if you're familiar with Elijah's God Answers by Fire, that legacy document we've had up, we presented this in that. And I've been updating it and expanding it to show more about our insight and to kind of fill some of you in who are familiar with our stuff, to help you follow along with what's really going on here. But in brief, Elijah is the bride. He's the bride here and in several other scenarios, especially in relationship with Elisha as the 144,000. But here we've got 12 stones, and we're dealing with 12 stones and water here, which should be familiar as time elements to you, especially if you paid attention to what we've written about Joshua chapter 3 and 4, when Israel crossed over the Jordan. And 12 stones were taken out, taken to Gilgal, set up as a memorial, and 12 stones were put back in the riverbed, where the former 12 had been taken out, which is around the feet of the priests who were holding the Ark of the Covenant. Yep, that's the Ark. That represented the presence of God, and it also represents the center of time. So when Elijah takes these 12 stones and builds up the altar, that's the 144,000. He takes one from each tribe, and we know there's 12,000 from each tribe. So how much water does he put on? He takes 4 jars of water and pours it on once, twice, and then 3 times. 3 times 4 is 12. And the water is a multiplication factor, basically, of time also. So we have 144,000. And so when they're the stones that he rebuilds the altar with, he makes a trench around them. And the Lord revealed to me about this trench, that it's the ceiling of the 144,000 for protection, which you can read about in Revelation chapter 7. And when he puts the wood in order and cuts the bull in pieces and lays it on the wood. Think about the sacrifice of the lamb and how Hebrews 10 talks about the sacrifice being Jesus, who replaces all the sacrifices of what could only be just a temporary work. He's the once for all permanent work. And so this represents, what wood is that? Well, he was hung on a tree. He was hung on a stake, a cross. And so this is that sacrifice. And so this is when it's laid on the altar, it's identified with 144,000. Once they're sealed, then it's like they're anointed. This is their recognition of Yeshua. They are identified with him in his death and resurrection. And when they pour the water on it, that's a baptism. It's a baptism anointing. It's a death and resurrection scenario. They're identified with the Lord in his death and resurrection. And that's very significant. And that's a critical work. And what that means is that with respect to Elijah as the bride, he's got to go. He can no longer be there because of the principle of Romans 11:15. So this is a parallel to what we see in Genesis 45. It's a parallel to what we see in John 21. And it also pictures, because of the resurrection there and what happens, what we see in Acts chapter 12. So with all these parables, we understand this is the last day of the feast of unleavened bread, Passover, and that is the dating on it. And we understand that's going to be in another 2.5 years in linear time. It's going to be in 2015. So what happens after that? Well, look at this. At the time of the offering of the oblation, bringing the appointed times into view, right to the center of our attention, Elijah is still at work. Wait, isn't he the bride? Didn't he go? Well, yes. But he's back. He's on a mission in his resurrected body. And it doesn't suggest that here in this account, but we know it from parallel accounts. This is the reality. This is the bride still at work. On a roll. Alongside the 144,000. And the mission here is obviously with respect to the rest of Israel. Verse 39 says, and when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and said, the Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God. And this is what we see in Genesis 45, where Jacob says, yeah, my son Joseph is alive. I'll go see him before I die. He gets it. And where Jacob there saw the carts, he heard the words of Joseph, and he saw the carts. Well, here, what does he see? He sees the fire of the Lord falling and consuming the burnt offering, the wood, the stones, the dust, except the water that's in the trench. And this has to do with the 144,000. And what happened when it licked up the water that was in the trench? Everything that was there in that whole area is gone, basically taken up to heaven. Gone. And so we know that according to the principle of Romans 11:15, what will their acceptance be but life from the dead? Yep, it's their turn. Off they go. Resurrection. Kind of a short trip, but we understand that this is when the altar's rebuilt. That's a picture of what's happening during the feast of Passover, unleavened bread. And then down here, this is Pentecost, when the fire falls and consumes them. And this is a wheat harvest that follows the barley harvest. So there's a lot of language that we can use that's all allegorical, metaphorical, figurative language. And this is the language of the Bible that the Bible uses over and over again to picture these events. If people are strictly focused on the natural and the physical realm, you'll never get to the place where you have insight into the prophetic layer. But when you understand about the times and you give them the attention that's due, the rest of this will unfold to you. Aaron, do you have anything you'd like to add on this?
One thing that came to mind as you were discussing, the fire falling there, in the John 21 example, after Peter's up on dry land, Jesus has fish on the fire, which can be another example there of that tribulation period and that second phase. So that's what came to mind is another example of that language and that modeling.
And it's important to realize the role of angels alongside this. And if you understand about the crossing of the Jordan when Elijah and Elisha went over, and Elisha witnessed Elijah being taken up in a whirlwind and then took Elijah's mantle and crossed back over the Jordan on dry land, this scenario that happened involved Elijah seeing horses of fire and chariots of fire, and they separated Elijah and Elisha. And then Elijah was taken up in a whirlwind, and Elisha saw the horsemen and the chariots of Israel. And so this fire, this flame that comes down and separates those who are being taken up, the bride, and now here the 144,000, the angels are involved, there's heavenly chariots involved, there's a show of fire. When Jesus himself ascended into heaven, he was received into heaven by a cloud, and he said he will return in like manner, and the cloud is another metaphor for heavenly stargate opening and transiting vehicles. These things we see over and over in a lot of different ways, and we have to understand that the Lord has manifestations regarding the fire and the water that are very relevant to pay attention to with regard to these transitional sequences. Thank you. God bless you.